The boom in oil production in North Dakota and Western Canada has turned the Great Lakes region into a transportation corridor for crude oil. The domestic production of oil has become a cornerstone of energy policy, both in the U.S. and Canada. But several high-profile spills, including the one on the Kalamazoo River in 2010, have raised questions about the safety of how we transport the increasing volume of oil moving through the region. The Great Lakes Commission looked into these questions in a new draft report released yesterday at their annual meeting. Joining us on the phone to talk about that report is the executive director of the commission, Tim Eder. Tim, welcome to Current State.
Well, welcome. Good morning, Scott. Good morning to all my fellow Spartans up in East Lansing.
It's always great to talk with a green blood. What is the Great Lakes Commission?
We are an organization that represents the states and provinces of the eight-state region. Most of our commissioners are appointees of the governors and state legislators. We have a lieutenant governor, but they represent the state and provincial governments.
What prompted the commission to author the report?
Well, the spill that you referenced, Scott, was one of the items that caught our attention. There was also a terrible train derailment in July of 2013 up in Quebec, and a train derailed carrying crude oil from the Bakken Formation in the Dakotas, derailed and burned up in a small town called Lac Mégantic, and 47 people were killed in that terrible accident.
Wow. How much has the volume of oil being transported changed in the past several years?
Oh, it's remarkable how much oil is being imported. And, you know, one of the things, this is a double-edged sword. I mean, there are real benefits for this oil being produced in the West. I mean, we're now importing we're producing more oil than we are importing in the United States. And we're still importing a lot from Canada. But this has been terrifically beneficial to our economy. But in the U.S., there's been a 75% increase in production in 2015, just over the last 6 years. And in Alberta, where the western oil sands are being produced, it's nearly doubled just since 2005.
Wow. Give us a word picture of how that oil moves through the region.
Well, it moves by three main modes. It moves by pipeline. There's the pipeline that goes through southern Michigan, the one that passed through where the spill occurred in Marshall. There's a pipeline that comes across the Straits of Mackinac and kind of goes down the east side of the state. Both of those go to Sarnia, to the refineries in Sarnia, across from Port Huron. So they cross the St. Clair River, again, between Port Huron and Sarnia. So there's the pipelines, and then there's rail lines, and then there's shipping, but shipping of crude oil is not taking place on the Great Lakes proper now. Most of the oil, there are petroleum products, refined products that move on the Great Lakes, small quantities that move here and there. There's crude oil that moves in inland waterways, and they just started shipping, just last week, they started shipping the first tanker of crude oil on the St. Lawrence River. So it could be coming. There are no immediate proposals to ship crude oil on the Great Lakes, but with this tremendous increase and the limitations and challenges with the existing infrastructure from rail and pipeline, there's no reason to expect that we wouldn't see a proposal to ship oil on the Great Lakes at some point in the future.
So what are the real risks to people in an environment of shipping crude oil on the Great Lakes?
Well, you know, the thing is that there's risks and advantages and disadvantages to shipping by all modes. But it's very difficult to quantify. I mean, how do you compare the risk of an accident such as the one that occurred in the little town in Quebec where 47 people were killed to the risk of a pipeline rupture underneath the Straits of Mackinac with the winds and the currents and the difficulty of cleaning up heavy crude? So it's really a challenge to try to quantify those different risks. It depends on the type of oil that's being shipped, whether it's highly volatile and explosive or whether it's heavy and it sinks. The place where it's shipped, is it over a freshwater environment or is it through a populous area? So it's difficult to quantify, but we know that there are serious potential risks for virtually all these modes. and advantages. You know, shipping by water is highly fuel efficient. It's generally an efficient way to move all products. There are regulations that have been in place since the Exxon Valdez spill in the 1970s that would require double-hull tankers for all vessels on the Great Lakes. And the Coast Guard has a pretty sophisticated oil response mechanism and inspections and enforcement and so on. However, the Coast Guard does not have the technology, the capacity, to clean up a spill of heavy oil in open water. It just doesn't exist. So, and the oil that's coming out of Alberta is heavy oil. So it sinks in water. It's currently not, it's impossible to clean up. So we don't think that the Coast Guard would permit it right now, but they might in the future. They might develop the technology and the equipment, and when a proposal comes along, they might permit it.
So what are the maintenance activities that actually go on? You're talking about the pipeline under the Mackinac Bridge and some of the other things that are happening. What kind of things do people do to minimize the risk of spills?
Well, of course, they're paying very close attention to it ever since the Marshall spill, the Enbridge line in Marshall that ruptured and spilled almost a million gallons. Attorney General Schuette and DEQ Director Dan Wyant have formed a task force, and they're looking very closely at that pipeline underneath Mackinac. And they're working with the company, trying to get the company to verify that they're doing frequent and careful inspections. They run these mechanized, they call them smart pigs, that run through the line and are able to, I don't know whether they do like an MRI or an X-ray or take pictures of the inside of the pipeline looking for inconsistencies and small cracks and failures in the line. One of the things that I learned is that pipeline was built in the, quote, good old days when they used thicker walls. It's supposed to have a wall thickness of close to an inch, and it was pretty stout. Now, it's been in there since the 1950s, though. So, you know, it moves around a little bit with the current and shifts, so it's very prudent of Attorney General Schuette and Director Wyant to be looking very closely at that thing.
Tim Eder is our guest. He's Executive Director of the Great Lakes Commission. Who regulates the transport of oil, and how much of a role do the states play versus federal and international governing bodies?
Well, the states have some authorities and ability to be involved in the regulatory process. It's primarily the federal governments, however. The states have some ability to influence the siting of pipelines when they're proposed. Once they're in, it's more challenging for the states to regulate. There is a lease agreement that enables the pipeline company to access the Straits of Mackinac, but it's a long-term lease and it doesn't expire, so there's no turnover period when the state can impose new conditions. But the state has, you know, the state has trust responsibility over all of the land and water resources within the state's borders. So they have, you know, and we have a very good administration that's looking out for our resources and are protecting our waters and lands. So they're doing everything that they can within the limits of the law.
Do you find that the residents in the areas where this stuff is happening sometimes say, "Not in my neighborhood"?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of the communities where the rail lines go through, they're seeing the product just goes through. It passes through. There's no direct benefit to the communities along the rail route. So they are concerned. They have to be prepared in the event of a derailment and a spill. So they have to have the training and the equipment and the emergency response capability. But they really don't receive any of the benefits. So, yeah, there are some communities that are saying this is a concern of ours.
The report says that there's increasing scrutiny when it comes to regulating the transportation of oil. What's an example?
Well, one of the things that's a concern is the type of rail car that's being used. It's classed as a D-111 car by the Department of Transportation, and it was the same type of car that blew up in the explosion in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a major push on to phase those cars out and transition to a newer, more modern, more secure car.
Where does the money come from for all of this?
Well, the money for that would come from the rail companies.
They're moving
tremendous volumes. A 68-fold increase in the number of rail cars moving between 2008 and the end of 2014. In 2008, there were 9,500 carloads of crude, and by the end of this year, it's going to be 650,000. So there's some tremendous increase in volumes. In fact, it's crowding out or making it more competitive for the other commodities that move by rail, such as grain and wheat and food products and other commodities. So the rail companies are making lots of money off of this boom.
Regulation sometimes comes after the fact, like the Exxon Valdez spill in 89. Are you hopeful that governments and industry and other stakeholders can coordinate to the point where we could preempt another disaster like Kalamazoo?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the point of our report, was to get a comprehensive understanding of all of the modes of transportation. We didn't set out to pick a winner or a loser in terms of shipping versus pipeline versus rail, but to look comprehensively at the state of play and the amount of increase and where the routes are going, and to prepare the states and provinces that we work for so that they can understand what some of the policy limitations are and plug those gaps before we do have any more accidents. We'd like to say that we're going to try to prevent terrible things from happening, but with the Lac-Mégantic and the Marshall spill, in addition to those, there were 20 other spills of some quantity, not as big or dramatic, but there were 20 spills just in the last 14 months in the U.S. and Canada.
We're talking to Tim Eder, Executive Director of the Great Lakes Commission. Tim, thanks so much for joining us on Current State.
You're welcome.
Go green.
Go green.